Joining us on the line now is William Hazelgrove. He's an award-winning, best-selling author of 10 novels and 7 non-fiction titles. He was the Ernest Hemingway writer in residence, where he wrote in the attic of Hemingway's birthplace. His latest book is Greed in the Gilded Age, The Brilliant Con of Cassie Chadwick. It's a Gatsby-esque, so hard to say that, a Gatsby-esque, there we go, tale of mystery, money, sex and scandal, and one of the greatest cons in American history. Welcome to the show, William.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for joining us. So her name then, Cassie Chadwick, she was actually born Elizabeth Bigley. Tell us a bit about her, because this is an amazing story.
Yeah, she was actually this drifter from Canada, came to America in the Gilded Age, stayed with her sister for a while. As a child, she had pulled off several cons where she'd basically, you know, created letters of credit and taken money. But when she got to America, she really set her sights on going for it all. And she basically said that she was the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie, the wealthiest man in America. And she had this crazy understanding of how bankers lent then. You know, then they would lend on perceived wealth. You didn't sign any documents. And so she would walk in and put these airs on as this very wealthy woman, and she wrote up very sophisticated trust documents showing that she was going to inherit Carnegie's fortune, and they all went for it. And so in short, she borrowed the equivalent of $60 million today and lived this incredible life of opulence.
Gosh, incredible stuff. And how many years was she living like this for?
You know, she went on, she really went on for about 5 to 6 years. She had managed to marry this doctor, Dr. Chadwick. And again, she pawned herself off as this rich heiress from Ireland. And this, of course, at a time when women were, you know, basically second-class citizens, didn't have the vote. And so she lived on Millionaire's Row, actually, in Cleveland. And when she did this, you know, they finally started to figure it out when a bank called the Oberlin Bank collapsed. Literally because she had cleaned it out. They'd given her all the depositors' money, and the bank failed, and all these people lost money. And that's really the only reason they started to figure out that, you know, she had loans everywhere.
Gosh, that's incredible. So she was arrested in 1904, and her trial in 1905 made bigger headlines than the inauguration of President Theodore Roosevelt.
That's right. It was the trial of the century. I wrote this book from all newspaper articles. There's thousands of them. This was huge. It was front page news. So they have the trial, and they call Carnegie in. Now, most people believed that what she said was true because she was regarded as this very wealthy woman. And they're like, well, why would she make this up? And Andrew Carnegie, you know, he's about 5 foot tall. He looks like a miniature Santa Claus with his big white beard. And they call him into the trial, and he goes. And Carnegie's an interesting guy because he made immense amounts of money. And he didn't quite understand how he did it. He wrote a book called Wealth that basically he tried to figure out why he made all this money and others didn't. Well, when he goes to Cleveland and he sits in the courtroom and confronts her, there's this moment, all the press is there, where he and Cassie lock eyes and they stare at each other. And Carnegie later wrote, he suddenly had the answer. It was just this incredible driving force of greed that he saw in her eyes that he realized was in himself. You know, he sort of had this epiphany at this moment. And you know, this was the moment of the trial where she and Carnegie faced off. And, you know, Cassie never, ever, you know, backed away from saying she was his illegitimate daughter. Now the way she set that up, this might be interesting to your listeners. She basically went to his home in New York to the mansion, took a lawyer with her named James Dillon. And James Dillon was a very well-connected financial lawyer. And she goes, James, will you wait here in the carriage while I go into my father's house? James Dillon's jaw just drops open. As she goes into Carnegie's house, she talks to a maid for like 30 minutes. comes back out, drafts a trust agreement in front of Dylan. He picks up and she goes, I got to tell you a story. I'm actually the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie, and I'm going to inherit his entire fortune. And she, then Dylan, she says, don't tell anybody. And then Dylan goes, of course, and tells everybody. And yes. And all these bankers fall all over themselves trying to give her money.
Gosh, isn't it bizarre? It's so, so mm-hmm. interesting. I mean, I assume you've seen the recent Netflix documentary, Inventing Anna.
I'm so glad you brought that up because I just
so
did
similar.
Watch it. And that is the same story. It is exactly the same. This happened 120 years before. I mean, because in Inventing Anna, she keeps telling everybody, my father will pay you off.
Yeah.
My father will pay you off. Well, that's what Cassie did. She would go to bankers and they would literally lend her $300,000 or $400,000. And she'd say, you know, I will put my money with you eventually when I inherit it, and my father will pay you off. And it was the exact same kind. And like Anna, she understood the greed that bankers had.
Yeah.
Because at this time, bankers expected kickbacks. So let's say you got $20,000. They expected you to give them right back $5,000. So she gave them enormous kickbacks, and they charged her exorbitant interest rates. But, you know, she really beat the 1% at their own game, which is really the premise of Inventing Anna. I mean, the stories, when I watched that, I was like, oh, my God, here it is, the modern version of Cassie Chadwick.
Yeah. I wonder if Anna knew about Cassie Chadwick.
You know, you have to wonder because it's so similar to the way she remade herself. And, I mean, Cassie Chadwick came from nothing. Elizabeth Bigley in Canada, her father worked for the railroad. I mean, she was dirt poor. And her first con, she took her mother's dress, took some makeup, dressed herself up, made her own hat, had a card made up that said she was going to inherit $15,000, went to a local bank, and got a line of credit. And then plastered the town with all these bad checks, all because she could, you know, they said she had this almost hypnotic quality with her eyes. She spoke with a lisp, had these sort of small white animal teeth, and then had to lean in to hear her. She was actually partially deaf. And you know, she was able to sort of make these men, and again, these were pretty sophisticated bankers, you know, basically give her all this money. Here's an amazing story. There's another bank called the Wade Park Bank, and this banker, he basically meets with her, and she presents to him a package. It's all bound up, and she says, listen, this is from my father. She tells him the whole Carnegie story, and in it is $5 million in securities. I need a line of credit from you. And this banker looks at the package and says, well, I should open it. And she says, well, do you doubt my word? And he looks at her in this, you know, very regal dress and everything. And he goes, oh, of course not. I would never doubt the word of a lady. And he gives her a line of credit for $5 million with ever looking in the package.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, you talk about these sophisticated bankers and things, but, I mean, you could call them something else, couldn't you? I mean, they kind of all sound a bit stupid.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, they were very, very in on it because, you know, they were, again, getting exorbitant fees. And, you know, when it all blew up, a lot of them said they couldn't believe she did this by herself and that there had to be a man behind it because only a man could figure this out.
Wow.
You know, and I mean, you know, so they just wouldn't even give her credit then. But she really did understand, you know, because I've looked at the trust. They were actually published in the papers that she wrote up, and they're very sophisticated. I mean, you know, she presented these documents to these bankers who read them and said, oh, yeah, this is legitimate. She really is going to inherit Andrew Carnegie's fortune.
Amazing.
And then just open the gates for her. Yeah.
I mean, you have to give her credit. I mean, what she was actual credit. What she did clearly was wrong and illegal, and she deserved to be punished for it. But I mean, what a clever woman!
Oh, absolutely. And you know, what they really convicted her of was just conspiracy to defraud this one bank, the Oberlin Bank. This man Beckworth, who gave her all the money from the bank, then gave her $100,000 of his own money, right? So he actually dies before the trial. It even comes to trial from just basically shame. He had been this very established banker. But, you know, they really didn't even convict her of any of the loans. They convicted her basically withdrawing money when it wasn't there. And, you know, again, I in the book, I have the parallel lives of her and Andrew Carnegie. And, you know, Carnegie was ruthless. You know, he had the homestead strikes. He had people shot down who were trying to get better wages and stuff. And yet, you know, here's Cassie Chadwick, who, in a sense, is just as ruthless and you know, gets this kind of money that Carnegie, although Carnegie had much, much more. Yet, you know, Carnegie goes on with his life, is revered, and Cassie Chadwick's clapped in jail for 11 years. So, you know, the lines of morality here are very blurred because she really, while she got this money from these bankers also were taking her for a ride as well.
Mm. And when he looked at her at that moment during the trial, you said they sort of had a moment. I wonder if he was quite kind of proud, I guess is the wrong word to use, because he obviously wasn't her father, but maybe admired what she'd achieved.
It's funny you said that, because he gave several interviews to the papers, and he said, you know, she obviously, you know, is very smart because she was able to get this money out of all these bankers. And this is at a time, you know, you have to put this in the time of the Gilded Age in America, where immense amounts of money were being generated, and these robber barons had come of age, and it was untaxed money, and people believed that they could get, you know, a pot of gold over the next hill. So this was this age, and all sorts of people were, you know, going for it, creating all these industries and such like that. And this is what Cassie came into. And she would go, you know, she'd go to New York on immense spending sprees, where she would, you know, buy all these diamonds. She would buy 8 grand pianos, just clean out stores. You know, when they finally caught up to her, they called to her in New York, and they chased her from one hotel to another. And they finally caught up to her, and she was in bed. And this sort of shows you the Victorian era. This big, burly, you know, sheriff came in and said, "Madam, I have an unpleasant duty." And she said, "But I am sick." He said, "I realize that, but I might have to place you under arrest. And it's unpleasant for me and unpleasant for you, but I will wait outside until you feel better." I mean, so again, this sort of decorum, you know, was there. That, and this also allowed her to operate, you know, because people had never seen this before. And again, most people thought that a man was behind it, that no woman could understand this financial world of the 1% the way she did.
Mm. So with Inventing Anna, obviously it was interesting to see how everybody close to her treated her around the time of the trial, whether people stood by her or wanted to distance themselves from her. How did it happen with Cassie when the trial happened?
Oh, great question. Yeah, so the trial happens, and all these bankers have pulled in. But a lot of them don't want anything to do with it, even though they lost money with her, because they don't want to be associated and have a run on their bank, which happened to the Oberlin Bank. The Oberlin Bank was cleaned out, and, of course, there was no FDIC, so nothing was insured. People just lost their money. So a lot of bankers just disappeared. Now, what's interesting is, several bankers stuck with her and said they believe she was still who she was, that she would, in fact, pay it off. In fact, Beckworth, who, again, his bank collapsed, he went to see her in prison and with his wife. And he said, "I still believe you will make good on this. I believe that you will pay this off." Because he couldn't believe that after 30 years as a banker that, you know, he had been duped by this woman. This woman was not who she said she was. And, you know, the trial, again, was just, you know, front page news every day. And you know, there was a feeling she might get off. And like Inventing Anna, you know, the questions of who used who here start to come up, right? I mean, yeah. Inventing Anna, people, you know, especially Rachel, who ends up, you know, making all this money off of Anna, actually, you know, selling her book and all that. And yet she took all this money, too. Well, this was very much Cassie Chadwick, too. These bankers made immense amounts of money, you know, from kickbacks and such like that. So you know, these lines were blurred. But, yes, people basically deserted her. And, you know, she was left to twist. And when her husband is really interesting. Dr. Chadwick, he had left for Europe because he knew his wife was doing something strange. He wasn't sure what. Well, they called him back and thought he was in on it. And, you know, so he got dragged into the trial. And, I mean, he was cleaned out. Basically, the banks all looked at him. He didn't have the money. And, you know, he, too, said, you know, this is a fabrication. This is, you know, my wife will be cleared of this. You know, right up to the end, he kept saying that, you know, this was all, you know, a lie, that she didn't do all this, that she was actually this very, you know, respected woman of the, you know, Millionaires Row in Cleveland. I mean, to the end, he believed her, but obviously it wasn't true.
Wow. So how did you hear about the story of Cassie Chadwick?
You know, I was looking around for, you know, I try and find interesting corners of history to write about. I wrote about, one of my other books was Madam President, The Secret Presidency of Edith Wilson, who ran the country from 1919 to 1921. And so I started reading about this woman who created this incredible scheme during the Gilded Age, and who netted millions of dollars by saying she was the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie. And by the way, Carnegie was besieged by reporters from this. His mansion was just besieged. He had to leave the United States for a while to get away from all the publicity. Because people really thought, you know, she might be that. So when I started to investigate it further, I realized there were no real books on it at this point. There was just nobody really written about it. So I was like, well, how to write about it? Well, then I started to discover all these newspaper articles. And again, this was front page news. And it just rolled on and on and on. And so I started to stitch it together that way. You know, and again, you know, Cassie is all about deception. She became clairvoyant for a while. Her name was Madame de Vere, where, you know, she would allow people to talk to the dead for a price. And, you know, she married another gentleman, had passed herself off as an heiress, actually had a son by him. He died. She inherited his money. She moved on. She just was, you know, this rolling stone, but she always remade herself. This is a time when people could change their name. There's no social security numbers or anything, really. And so she'd literally change her name overnight and become somebody else.
Incredible. What a story. Well done for finding it and writing a book about her. I have to ask you about Ernest Hemingway being a writer in residence, where he in the attic of Hemingway's birthplace. How fascinating that must have been.
Yeah, it was great. I actually happened to live in Oak Park, which was where he was born, and I had a book contract for my third novel at the time, and I needed a place to write, and they were nice enough. I went on a tour of the house and went up to the attic, and it was this big Victorian cavernous attic. And, you know, I said, hey, you don't think I could ever write up here? And they were like, oh, no. And so I sort of forgot about it. But then Virginia Casson, who was the president of the Ernest Hemingway Foundation, called me and said, you know, we wouldn't mind you writing up there. And so that's how I did it. I sort of would go up there every day, and cold in the winter, hot in the summer. And wrote up there, you know, amongst all Hemingway's bric-a-brac and things and old books and all that up there.
Oh, it must have been so surreal, a real kind of pinch yourself moment every day, I should imagine.
Yeah, it was. It was surreal. Because I would be in that big old Victorian house at night and, you know, come down from that attic. And that was very creepy at times. And, you know, but, you know, it was great. I'm glad I did it. But, you know, his legend is so big that at a point I knew I had to leave, you know. So, cause you can just get subsumed by the Hemingway, you know, legend and just his force of personality, and it's all in that house. So,
wow.
Everywhere.
Amazing. Well, if people want to get a copy of your latest book, it's called Greed in the Gilded Age. It's by William Hazelgrove, who we've been chatting to. The book is available on our website, tre.radio. William, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.